Hey everyone, you're listening to the Simple Electronics Podcast. I'm your host, Simple Electronics, and with me today I've got a very special guest, Scott the Deaf Palm. How are you, Scott?
Good, thanks. How's it going?
It's going all right. For some reason I'm feeling tired today, but it's been a nice day. I really have no excuse. How are you?
Good. It's 11 o'clock in the morning here, so that's still fairly early. I'm literally woken up now.
You're in the southern hemisphere, if I understand correctly. So you're just going, you're heading, you know, to the end of winter now, or midwinter, something like that?
We're midwinter pretty much, yeah. And I'm in New Zealand.
And how's the weather in midwinter? Is it cold, or is it still tolerable?
It's actually pretty good. I mean, right now it's 13 degrees Celsius outside.
Yeah, I wish it was 13 here. I mean, Canada's known for it being cold. But I think it was 27 or something today, and when the sun was out, it was too much for me.
No, yeah. It does get pretty hot here sometimes too, but middle winter is usually quite mild here. It's pretty good. We don't really have to worry too much about getting too cold. It does have periods where it gets a bit colder, but generally it's, you know, a few days here or there, then it's all right again.
You guys have like a rainy season, don't you?
Yeah, kind of. It's not so bad. It doesn't rain that much, really. It's relatively mild, but it does get some quite heavy rains, but it's usually for, you know, an hour or two, and that's gone again.
Okay, that's not so bad. And how's life? Are you guys post-coronavirus, or are you guys still in the coronavirus? How's that happening?
We're basically corona-free. So the government here has been quite well managing a lot of things. Not perfect, but, you know, most governments aren't perfect. And they've been doing some good work to try and protect the borders and control that aspect. So the only virus issues we have, yeah, did have some breaks initially, but we haven't had anything really in the community for a long time now. And the ones we did have are relatively minor, you know, and it's talking about hundreds of people, not, you know, not tens of thousands or anything like that. So the only stuff we've really got now is like the quarantine facilities where people come into the country when they're coming in, and they have to sit there for, you know, a couple of weeks before they can come in.
That makes a lot of sense. We had we just got rid of our 2-week quarantine upon coming into the country if you are vaccinated, but we're slowly reopening everything up. We should be back to normal in a month or two, because I think we're up in the 70s to vaccination rate. Did you guys do vaccination, or more like was it really hard quarantining instead?
We did a lot of lockdowns, as everybody's done, basically. We've had three or four, some of that, I can't remember, but they've all been fairly short ones. I think the longest one was the first one we had. We've had like a couple for like a week or two as well, had a couple of those. Very short ones when there's been like a minor outbreak somewhere in the community where someone slipped through. The vaccination process is undergoing. It's in process now, but it's only early days. It's only really sort of started in the past couple of months. And obviously priority was given to the border workers and ports and stuff like that. And now it's gradually going out into the community to the more at-risk people first. But as we don't actually have it out widespread, you know, it's not in the community anyway. There's no real risk for us right now for delaying it. So I'm kind of in opinion that the countries that need it more should be getting the vaccines anyway.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. It's nice sometimes being on an island. I'm sure that helps for some aspects of it at least.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. There's been some mistakes made at borders where people have slipped through or not followed the rules because, you know, people don't follow rules, do they, generally? They like being told what they're doing. So there have been a few people which have jumped over fences and things like that, but yeah, it's not too bad, though. It's been under control mostly.
Well, speaking of not following the rules, typically I ask my guests to introduce themselves and who they are and what they do, and I guess I skipped right over that because I had other stuff on the brain. Do you mind letting our viewers, which they should know who you are, but the ones who don't, let them know who you are?
Oh, I'll go as the Deaf Palm. I've been on the internet for a while, various guises. By basically doing a YouTube channel, well, it's also on Odyssey and other platforms as well, but primarily YouTube, and I'm doing lots of electronics repairs and electronics-based content, so it's like mailbag videos, product reviews. I like to repair a lot of test equipment, so old broken test equipment for some late 70s, 80s, maybe early 90s, that kind of era. So I buy broken gear off eBay and try to fix it and do videos about them and try and sort of help people out as well, which may be having the same kind of problems with their gear. I show common pitfalls, that kind of thing. So that's what I'm doing right now anyway, mostly.
What's your favorite kind of gear to look for on eBay? Like, what's your favorite search terms, let's just say?
Parts and repair. That's probably the biggest first search term I'm using. I'll do things like looking for brands like maybe HP, because that's the right era, HP. Maybe Agilent, because it's a bit earlier. Keysight's too new. So anything that kind of Keysight brand is usually a bit too modern and usually too expensive for me to worry about buying, because, you know, limited budgets and what have you. So I try and go older stuff like maybe Recordana, Marconi, but I don't like anything valve-based. Valve-based is beyond what I do. So anything, you know, sort of think about 80s kind of electronics, that kind of region, that's where I'm looking at.
Are you finding a lot of stuff that is falling into the capacitor apocalypse? Like, you know, the, what was it, early 2000s, late 90s, where all the capacitors would explode?
I think there was a batch of, I think, well, my understanding of that was that there was a potential commercial issue going on there where someone stole someone's formula for their capacitor electrolyte, and then it got leaked and some other people started making it, and that's my understanding anyway from what I heard. But yeah, as generally anyway, what I do with my gears is I replace the capacitors anyway, because I just, that age capacitors, you think about the usage of the capacitors, the actual specifications specify a number of hours usage. And there might only be 2,000 hours, 5,000 hours, maybe 10,000 hours of usage. When you got a piece of test gear which could have been on constantly for 10 years in a lab somewhere, you know, 20 years ago, then its hours are one and truly up. So I pretty much replace them as a matter of course anyway. Even if I don't have the right parts, I will probably try and mash something up or at least test what's there to confirm if it is a bad or not. But generally, I'll just replace on site.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially, yeah, electrolytics dry out, or sometimes they get really hot, like the 105 degrees C rating doesn't necessarily mean much if it's like continued exposure. So that makes sense. Replacing capacitors is typically a good place to start for anybody who wants to repair stuff. I know a lot of flat screen TVs are rendered useless from cheap capacitors that either leak or don't meet their ESR standards anymore or whatever, something like that.
Yeah. So I actually did some videos on my TV when I had some problems with the power supply. I was getting really noisy. You could hear it buzzing and clicking. The TV was still working. I did some videos on that and actually stripped it down and recapped it all, and it's been working fine ever since. But that's just bad capacitors. You know, I didn't actually have to do any diagnostics. I just replaced parts. Sometimes you don't really have to think about what you're doing. You can just dive in there and, you know, swap bits out, and it's pretty basic stuff in most cases.
Yeah, capacitor was the first place I looked when my AC started making a lot of noise. So I can't handle the heat and my air conditioning unit started buzzing like crazy. I was afraid that the compressor went kaput, because basically a compressor has a lot of moving parts, and that's kind of like, the compressor is kind of like the biggest deal in your AC system. But once we ripped the cover off, I saw that the capacitor was bulging, and it tested zero. There was no microfarads left. So, you know, $20 later and we got working AC, but that was a close call.
Yeah. It's always nice to have easy fixes like that. I quite like easy fixes. Nobody wants to think all the time.
So what would you say is your greatest score from used or broken gear on eBay? What's the thing that's maybe the most valuable in your shop that you got on eBay?
Well, it's probably one of my most recent acquisitions is probably the most valuable one I've got right now. I've done lots of smaller stuff and like cheaper value things, which have been just curiosities, which are handy to have. But the current one I've got, which is, well, the most recent one I've received, is a Datron 4700 calibrator, which calibrates AC, DC, resistance, and current to a small level. But it does up to like 1,000 volts, AC and DC, that kind of thing. It's a fully optioned unit. And they're not cheap to buy. It's about 2,500 New Zealand. So I think it's about 1,200 US, I think I got it for, something like that. Was that the conversion rate was at the time? But by the time I actually got it in my hands, after paying import duties and transport costs and that sort of stuff, it's like $5,000 New Zealand. And I managed to get it working. I actually broke again a couple of weeks ago, and I fixed it again. But I think that was a continuation of the original fault that it had, which I kind of hid by resoldering some of the boards. and I think it partially repaired the device, which was playing up, and it kept it going a bit longer. Then it failed again, and I managed to track it down not longer and repaired it again. So that's now worth about $10,000. So I basically doubled the money on that for putting in, I don't know, probably 20 hours work.
Would you ever sell it now?
No.
No? Just you're just going to keep using it?
Yeah, I got that because I wanted one. Because I have had other calibrator gear, like a Fluke 5200A, which is an AC calibrator, but that doesn't have the high voltage unit with it, which is a massive, massive heavy block. I think it weighs something like 40 kilos for that expansion. It's a heavy thing. And the 5200A can only do like 100 volts or something AC. I've also got Fluke 343A, which is a 1,000 volt calibrator as well, DC. And a Fluke 5450A, I think it is, which is a resistance calibrator. So I've been picking up these calibrators over time. Again, all these things have been broken. I purchased them, I've repaired them all. Because that's why I've been expanding my test equipment collection, is by buying broken stuff because I can get it much cheaper and fixing it.
And do you ever feel the need to send, let's say, the calibrator out to get professionally verified, like for accuracy, or you're not really bothered by that? You're pretty sure it's going to be pretty accurate?
I'd like to do that, but it costs a lot of money. And I'm not like I'm doing anything commercially or anything like that, so the actual accuracy doesn't really matter. It only really matters to me. So I do things by cross-checking against different bits of gear and just basically trying to get a match between what matches. So, you know, if I've got two or three pieces of gear, if they all kind of agree with each other, you can be fairly confident it's kind of all right. But then if you've got two or three bits of gear which you fixed, you still got a doubt in your mind about, are they right? Are they all just gone off by the same mount in the same direction? You never quite know.
Yeah, I tend to do the same kind of thing. There's a word for that kind of calibration where you use sort of other things to check it up against. And think in the long run, like using enough gear on it, like doing enough testing with different pieces of gear will get you pretty damn close to the right range. But some of these calibrators, like this calibrator, how many digits do you think it's accurate to?
It's capable of calibrating 6.5-digit multimeters. So it's actually got a 7.5-digit range. So you always do one order of magnitude more than the device you're trying to calibrate.
Yeah, so that's difficult then to test it with devices, because then you would need again an 8.5-digit multimeter really to take a look at it proper, right?
Yeah, that's right. You need, in order to verify that, you need another digit. So it just never ends, really. It's this whole vault nut thing where you have to just keep on going deeper and deeper down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, or you need to find yourself a neighbor that has a similar one, and then you guys can cross-check.
Yeah. So what I've actually got is, so this calibrator, when I repaired it, it did have issues with the reference board, but I didn't really change anything on it. So I was fairly confident. When I cross-checked that against my other equipment, like I had a HP 3457A, which is a 6.5-digit multimeter from HP. That, when I purchased it, was supposed to be NIST traceable calibrated. That was about 7 or 8 months ago now, something like that. And I kind of trusted that one, but not 100%, because that was agreeing with some of my other gear, but on some ranges it was off by a bit. So I think it is not calibrated well. So I don't completely trust that. But as I've been doing cross-checks with that against some other equipment, I kind of trusted as well. I could see what was wrong, what wasn't, compared to what made sense, because you could do a manual ranging and you could do a cross-check against a manual ranging. And you can see, that range is definitely wrong, because when you shift ranges, it steps up or it steps down a bit, which means it's wrong. So it gives you a bit of a clue in that way as well. So you can help narrow down which one is actually wrong with it. It's the HP or whatever. But I've got a Siglent SDX 3065X multimeter here, which I purchased brand new a few years ago now. And so it's a 6.5-digit multimeter as well. And so that's a pretty good reference. And that's drifted off a little bit over time because it uses the LM399 reference. And they've obviously got an aging process, and as they age, they drift off a little bit and they gradually stabilise. And that's been a good reference as well. And I actually recently calibrated that using the Datron calibrator. And I did a bit of a video on that, but that's top secret right now. Siglent don't want anyone to know how to do that yet. So I'm one of the few which know how to do it.
Interesting. Very interesting. Are you... So sorry, it's a secret and you're going to release the information, or it's a secret and you're going to keep it secret for now?
I'm keeping it secret until Siglent say it can be released, because I have a relationship with Siglent where I'm quite good friends with a Siglent distributor in New Zealand, and so I'll get lent gear to do reviews on, so I'll do videos with the gear that I'll get lent, and I'll have to give it back, unfortunately, but at least I get to make the videos with the content, which is quite good. So because I had that relationship with them, and I've been doing some giving feedback, and they actually listen to my feedback and they watch my videos, I actually have a bit of an input there to Siglent, so that if I find something I'm not happy with, they'll actually take it on board quite often. Not always, but they actually do listen, which is quite good. So I'm trying to maintain that relationship with them, making sure I don't do anything to hinder that, because it's a good relationship and you've got to try and keep those kinds of things level-headed. But also, I need to try and balance what Siglent might want versus what the general community might want. So at the moment, I'm just holding off and just saying, okay, giving Siglent a chance, because they are trying to work through a process of releasing this calibration information. They've written the information, but they're restricting access to it at the moment. So I think they're still trying to just determine exactly the consequences of releasing it and that sort of stuff, and trying to determine if the information's clear enough for people to follow, which is part of the reason I made this video for them, so they can see how I do it and how things could be done a lot easier. So I did actually suggest to them an alternative method of doing a calibration, which is far simpler. But from what I've heard so far, they're a bit reluctant to change. But they may take it on board in time, though.
That's super interesting. And I'm really glad you have a working relationship with Siglent like that. There's another New Zealand YouTuber that I watch quite a bit, which I don't know if you know him, Bruce Simpson from RC Model Reviews.
No, not familiar with that.
Yeah, I was throwing it in the dark. I'm not saying it's because you guys are both Kiwis. I was just saying because he's into electronics too. So, you know, your paths may have crossed at some point. But he had a working relationship with an RC radio company. And for some reason, I guess they weren't happy with the performance they were getting from his videos. They dropped him altogether, which is... That's pretty sad to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so my relationship with Siglent is I'm just sort of using them to get content, because as a YouTuber, as you would know yourself, part of the battle is trying to find things to do videos on. And having Siglent as a source of, you know, give me a equipment which has been recently released and I can just do a review on it, that's given me some good content for the channel and helps keep the channel propped up as well. So if there's nobody else out there with a video about a particular piece of gear which has just come out, I'm the only one who's got a video, then that gives me a bit of an advantage in that way. So I'm benefiting from that exposure. That's basically the relationship I've got with Siglent in that way. But, you know, I've not actually got a sponsorship or anything like that. So it's purely just content.
Yeah, I'm relying on Banggood right now for my source of product reviews, because the money's been a bit tight because I've been between contracts. I'm just starting working again now, so things are going to be less tight. But unfortunately, Banggood has just kind of dropped off the map for me, so I'm not sure if that'll continue. I mean, it is what it is, but yeah, they were my source of of review content. Did you have a deal with Banggood too? Because I saw a couple of things, like you were advertising your Banggood links. Is that all on your own, or did they contact you for a sponsorship?
They've contacted me, and I do have a relationship with them for doing review stuff, so they send me gear for free, and I'll do reviews on things. Generally, I'll request something I'm interested in. Sometimes they may suggest something, but that's not so common. But I'll probably review, I don't know, probably maybe once a month or something like that, maybe less, I'll do a review. Because I'll request something, they'll send it, I'll do the review, go through that process, publish it, and then I request something else. And that can be at least a month in between. So I don't do that many. I've done a couple of things recently. One of the things I picked up recently from them was a ProSKIT SS331, which is a desoldering station. And that's actually quite a nice little bit of gear. So that's sitting on my desk right now. It's now my new desoldering station, which is like a desoldering gun thing, you know. So that's one example of one of the things I get from them. And obviously, I didn't have to pay for it, which is great. So I'm expanding upon my equipment availability, and it doesn't cost me anything, which is brilliant, because I've always got to try and then I can put my money into buying broken test gear to make videos instead. You know, that's what I'd rather do, is put money into buying things. I don't make any money from the channel. All the money I do get goes back into buying things to make content with.
Oh, yeah. Between Patreon, AdSense, and a little bit of affiliate money that I make, I'm still far in the negative. So it's just the nature of YouTube at the moment.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, if you think about this Calibrator I purchased, mind you, that's for my own use as well. So it's not just about content. You know, that's years worth of earnings. You know, so just that one thing. So I do tend to try and keep my general budget for items I purchase to be around maybe $300 or $400 US is what I'd like to try and target. But the biggest problem I've got is the postage costs. So I might be selling you, which is like $100 US, it'd be great. I'd like to get that. But then the postage is $800 US.
Yeah, New Zealand is particularly bad for shipping. As far as I've heard from Bruce Simpson, Canada is bad as well. The Americans really have it easy here when it comes to shipping.
Yeah, it seems like the postage is really skewed towards not shipping internationally.
And you guys have to pay import tax on pretty much everything you bring in, right? Something like that?
Yeah, that's right. It's all dutied on overseas now. So Banggood, AliExpress, for example, if you buy things on those sites, it gets GST added instantly. eBay does the same. When you buy stuff from them, they put duty on as well.
Yeah, so far so good for us on this end. The only time we really pay duty is when something comes from the US or Mexico and is not from the US or Mexico. In that case, we pay a pretty hefty duty. But other than that, like stuff coming in directly from China, we don't have to pay for. And most shipping that comes in internationally that is labeled like a gift or engineering sample or prototype or whatever isn't taxed either, because it's just, I think it costs more money to try to figure out what it's worth to tax it than to just put it through. So far, so good. But yeah, I heard some countries like New Zealand is quite difficult in that aspect.
Yeah, part of the problem as well, if you do have a situation, you purchase something overseas and it hasn't been taxed at the source, when it comes in and they detect it's not been taxed, which is fine, they'll then slap on not only the duty of the actual value of the goods, but they'll also have all the administration fees on top of that. And sometimes the administration fees are almost as much as the duty cost.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, it is.
We have that. So if I get stuff shipped from the US, which happens a lot because let's be honest, they're a population center, so they have most stuff in stock. If a courier brings it up, like DHL, UPS, or FedEx, they have their own administration fees. And typically, their administration fee is something like $30. And then if you add the duty, which, you know, usually ends up around $18 or something like that, it adds $50 to the shipping cost, which was already like something like $60. So, like, it's expensive to bring stuff in from the States sometimes. And if it's something odd, like Zach Friedman was talking about shipping laser cutters, to bring a laser from the US to Canada is like, it's a bureaucracy nightmare. Like, you basically can't do it. So the whole thing is just a pain in the butt.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is what it is. You know, you just have to work with a system that's in place and hope for the best and just put up with it pretty much. There's no real control we have over it. We just have to live with it. So, you know, it is what it is, really.
Yep. I see on your channel about a month ago, you were playing with a free touch deck. How did you like that?
I still haven't got it working fully yet. It's because I've got issues, I think, with my computer more than anything else. So the touch deck itself seems to work. So what I actually had from that was a board which I designed about a year or so ago. Might be early this year. One of the projects I built, I'll just digress slightly. The projects I built was a LoRa gateway. So you could have a LoRa network which then jumps across to a Wi-Fi gateway. So I'm using an ESP32 as a Wi-Fi interface and LoRa modules to get data from this network, which I'd built. And so you can then have devices talking to a website or whatever directly through the LoRa network jumping across the gateway. So this board I actually built for that, I could then actually just adapt its device slightly and just, because it had a TFT touch display on it and stuff like that, so that was all easy, and I just basically just reprogrammed it, and I think I had to change one wire, put a different wire link on it or something, like I think it was, and that actually then just worked. So it's really easy for me because I had the bits, I had the boards, I had all the TFT display, I had all that stuff already here. So it's really easy for me to build one. I know that Dustin Watts He does sell a touchdown. Come on, it's not. He doesn't call it free touchdown. He calls it something else.
ESP 32 touchdown. Yeah, ESP 32 touchdown. That's right.
Yeah. So now he sells those as well, which is good. Makes it easy for people which don't have the same skill set. But it's got good potential. I mean, I communicated with my wife's computer. I had it hooked up onto that, and it was seemingly working fine on hers. I had an issue with my computer because I'm using an old Mac Pro from 2010. And that had an older version of Bluetooth on it, so I wouldn't communicate. So I actually updated that computer to use a newer version. I published that video the other day, actually. And but that seems to have issues in itself. So although it is a newer version of Bluetooth, so they can kind of connect and communicate slightly, it's not reliable. So I think it's something to do with the actual device, because there's a Broadcom chipset that's in it. And apparently Broadcom one's not having a lot of fun with the touch deck stuff, like the at least with the USB 32 communication through Bluetooth. So I think I actually need to just dump that Broadcom switch, Broadcom one, and go to, there's another brand, I can't think what it was now, but there's another manufacturer of chipset, and that one does actually work, apparently. So that one's known to be working okay when the Broadcom one's been playing up. So I've got to actually just probably put my original card back in again, because that was actually working fine, actually working better for range, for Wi-Fi and stuff like that. And it's used a plug-in dongle, which is probably what I should have done the first time. It would save a lot of work.
Yeah, I've got a cheapy Chinese dongle that I just picked up. I think they were a buck on eBay a while ago. And it seems to work pretty fine with that. But I need to sit down and actually program everything up in OBS. And, I need to do the linking of the hotkeys to stuff. But other than that,
yeah,
it's a fantastic project. And actually, Dustin actually sent me a ESP32 touchdown. So now I have two free touch decks, one for me and one for my wife, and I've got an ESP32 touchdown. So now I'm all set. I should be all good to go at this point.
Yeah, cool. Because you can actually use it for other things apart from streaming as well, because it's just sending key commands to your computer. So you can actually use it in like your editing software, stuff like that. You can actually use it in that to control certain functions. So in that regard, it's really flexible, because you can just tell it what you want to do and you send those commands through, and you have to make sure you're just in the right program at the time. It's all. So it's got great potential, so I'm quite looking forward to getting it going properly. But yes, I spent that money upgrading my computer thing, and that'll do the job, and it's not done the job. So, but that's, you know, the thing of having an 11-year-old computer. Well, it still works quite well for video editing, because it's a massive thing, but yeah. It's probably not that fast compared to what's around today, though.
Yeah, I think that's the deal with the Mac Pros, is that they were very good at creativity and productivity tasks, and they were kind of mediocre at everything else. And people still use them today for productivity, because that's what they were designed for. Like, they had massive amounts of RAM. They always had the fastest available storage at the time. They always had high quality components. But it's transferred through. Even today, the Mac Pro is a bit ridiculous in price, the new one. But they are using, I think, Gen 4, PCIe Gen 4 NVMe storage, which is like really expensive parts. So like, it just is what it is.
Yeah. What I do like about the Macs is the quality of the build. So the actual electronics quality is usually pretty good. I know the laptops get a bit of a hard time for being failure prone, at least the current ones especially. But that's usually because of being, you know, they've had water put on them or some kind of drink spilt on them. Well, we can't really blame the electronics for that. I mean, yes, it's going to fail. But what I'm not liking is the tendency for Apple these days, this is my opinion, obviously, to make things hard to repair. So they've been going further and further away from repairability. The current phones and laptops, stuff like that, they are very hard to repair in some ways because the information's not out there to do it. And parts availability is, well, you're relying on getting used parts. I've done a bit of phone and MacBook repairs myself, so I'm relying on buying used parts from China most of the cases, apart from like screens and stuff like that. You usually get aftermarket screens, which aren't quite as good, but they're okay. So that kind of thing, where like circuit diagrams, you're relying on things which have been linked onto the internet on some forum somewhere, and you're downloading God knows what in order to try and to get a circuit diagram to see how to fix the thing you own. So that kind of thing I don't like. That whole right to repair, I think, is a very important topic, which is going around currently and it's being discussed quite a lot. And I think that's great that that's being discussed, because it really does need to be. Because one of the reasons I like to fix things and like the test gear, especially this old stuff, is I don't like to see things being wasted. A lot of effort and a lot of design has been put into something to make it. And to throw it away because one $2 part or whatever is blown, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's hugely wasteful. And society these days seems to be going towards this quick, you know, buy it cheap, throw it away when it's broken thing. Well, that's not, you can't just keep doing that forever because you end up with running out of resources and, you know, the landfills will be full of electronics goods. It's just ridiculous. It's just, it's very much, I believe, manufacturer focused where they're just trying to sell things as quickly as often as they can. So, you know, I'll buy a new phone every year. Why? My phone is 4 or 5 years old. I'm using an iPhone 6S, which I've had since new. You know, I like iPhones. I just don't like the philosophy behind the making things hard to repair aspect of things. And trying to claim IP and that sort of stuff, I think is a load of rubbish.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget, there's a reason why reduce and reuse are before recycle, because it should be in that order. You either you use less or you reuse old stuff or you recycle, but it's in that order. So I feel like what you're doing is either reduce because you're reducing the need for new gear, and reuse, you're reusing old gear that were destined for the dump. So that's the important part, right? Reduce, reuse. And then when it's useless, then you recycle.
Yeah, we can only do so much. Sometimes the things are just beyond repair and you can't do anything about that. But then you may be able to use the parts from that, which are still salvageable, to fix something else. So it's not total loss. You know, you can still carry on and help prevent something else going to the landfill. So I'm quite passionate about that side of things. And I'm not like a greenie, really, you know, as it were. But I still don't like to see wastage and like, It just seems really wrong to me that all these resources are going into trying to make you buy more so companies can make obscene profits. It's just wrong. But yeah, it's a challenging thing because it's sort of, if you think about the new thing with electric cars, EVs, there's a bit of a push for those right now. And they're obviously really cool and it's nice and advanced and stuff like that. It's got some great technologies involved. But how long do the batteries last? And when the batteries are gone, it's cheaper to buy another car than it is to get a new battery in most cases. From what I've seen, from what I've seen expressed on the internet and stuff like that, and what I've seen mentioned locally, it's cheaper to go and buy another car than it is to get a new battery for the car. So maybe in 5 years, you throw your car away and get another one. Well, manufacturers are loving that because that means they get to sell your new car every 5 years instead of however many decades it may be. For example, my car is 17 years old.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm just going to say I'm a little bit more excited for the electric car boom personally, because to me that means there's going to be a lot of high quality lithium cells that we'll be able to salvage, like people like you and me, obviously, not the everyday people. And also these high output, high torque, highly sophisticated electric motors and gear trains are going to be available as well in the scrapyards, and that excites me. I am sad that, yeah, once a battery goes completely kaput, the car is probably going to be scrapped. But I guess on the bright side, all these cool parts are going to go into the used parts circulation, which I'm pretty excited for.
To a point, yes. But what will happen is once the market's saturated, then what? Because there's only going to be so much demand for used motors and, you know, bits and pieces like that. So what I think really is the issue is that I don't mind progress away from fossil fuels. I think that's a good thing. But I think the battery technology is not there yet. I think what we need to probably be looking at is hydrogen-based systems, which don't rely on batteries.
Yeah, I sort of agree with you. I mean, I agree with you that the battery tech is still a little distance away. I mean, we do have ways to refurbish cells, like obviously not individual cells. It would have to be like take out, remove the spot weld new cells in. So it's a little bit less reduce, reuse, and a little bit more recycle. But hydrogen has big difficulties as well because it costs a ton of electricity to split the hydrogen from the oxygen. And then it's very difficult to store it and transport it. I think it is a step in the right direction, but I'm not sure if the hydrogen car is actually as progressive as we think it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's all against four against both, isn't there?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Nothing's perfect yet.
The best part of the hydrogen vehicle is that you can recharge it, quote unquote, in the same amount of time it takes you to fill up your fuel tank. That's yeah. The great part. And, you know, it's basically zero emissions because what comes out is water. The water comes out of the tailpipe, basically. But yeah, unfortunately, someone has to figure out storage of hydrogen because it's very costly at the moment, like resource wise and straight up cost wise. So that's the unfortunate part.
Yeah, it is. Nothing's perfect yet. It's still got a long way to go. Long way to go yet.
We need little portable nuclear reactors. I think that's what we need.
Yeah, I just imagine what happens when you crash your car, though.
Well, I mean, just be careful, I guess. People will drive more carefully if they knew they had a nuclear bomb basically strapped behind their seat.
Maybe so.
Maybe. You've dabbled a little bit in programming, you were telling me. But something that I didn't realize that you made is I'm sorry, I forgot the name, but you made a parts inventory tracker.
Oh, yes. My Parts Bin, it's called.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that project?
Yeah. So I was actually discussing a little while ago with Sion, the Unexpected Maker, probably a year or so ago now, actually. I was chatting to him during one of his live streams, and he was talking about doing a parts inventory site. And I've had it in my mind for a while, because with all the bits and pieces I buy in mailbags, and trying to remember where everything was always getting to be a bit of a challenge. And, you know, not buying stuff twice because I've forgotten I already had it once. That kind of thing. So I decided to basically build something simple. And it was really for me. And I thought, well, I can make it available to other people as well. So I just built this really basic website. It's extremely basic. It's very rudimentary in what it can do. And it's intentionally that way to make it easy to use. But the system is that it's open source. So what's on the website, you can use as a standalone website, or you can download a version you can run on your own web server. And you can do it that way. But the version you download is obviously not exactly the same as the website because of security issues. Obviously, you've got to be careful about leaking too much code out there. So the security code and the restrictions for anti-hacking sort of stuff I've got built into the website is stripped out from the public code. So people don't actually know how I'm trying to restrict those hacking attempts and stuff like that. So that's all kind of secret. So because if I leaked that out there, people won't know how to try and work around problems. But the... So the idea is that you can actually transfer your inventory from your own computer, from your own web server, onto the website and vice versa. So you can actually back it up between the two. And so you can maintain your own inventory and dump it onto the website as a backup, or vice versa, use it on a website. And you can actually download your inventory yourself. And it can actually use like an Excel file or CSV, I can't exactly what it was now. But you can actually just populate it yourself and upload it as well and do it that way. And it tracks links to like purchase pages and stuff like that as well. But it's fairly basic and rudimentary, but that's what I wanted anyway, to keep it really simple.
And like, so the motivation was because you didn't want to, you wanted a way to track your parts, but then you just released this to everybody for free? Like, how are you getting, I mean, the web service costs something, doesn't it?
It cost me basically nothing. I actually run a hosting service as well. Because, well, kind of. It's really from my own website. So I came to the conclusion many years ago that having paid cloud hosting for lots of websites is rather expensive. And it worked out a lot cheaper to buy a rehosting service, so or like a reseller program. So you can sell hosting. And it's actually cheaper to buy that kind of package and then chuck all your websites on that one package. And, you know, you can make as many websites as you want. It doesn't cost you anything. So you're just paying that one cost per month for the rehosting seller option, and you can do what you want with it pretty much. And you've also got a lot more control in some ways anyway. You still do have some restrictions on the overall hosting body, which owns the service, but it means I can do things like just throw a website together and put it up and doesn't cost me anything, which means it's really easy to do things like make these open source things and to say, yeah, go for it. It doesn't cost me anything. It doesn't matter to me.
And if somebody saw this project and, you know, or any of your projects and felt like they wanted to support you for these projects, best place to do that would be Patreon?
Patreon's preferred as well, yes. I do have a Patreon account. I've also got the memberships on YouTube as well. But the memberships on YouTube is YouTube take a fair chunk. I think it's about 30%, I think they take. If I'm, I could be quoting that wrong.
No, I think it's 30%. But, and then minus the taxes to now, I don't know if your country got dinged, but mine did.
Yeah. I'm getting taxed as well for that. So Patreon's preferred. Other thing with Patreon is that when I publish videos, I do like a pre-release, and Patreons will get those custom posts. And if it's a repair video or something like that, I usually link into that post the service manual or any data sheets, stuff like that, which are relevant to that repair. So I'll link all that together. So it's like a package of the repair with all the information for it. Whereas on YouTube, I don't have that availability. I can't do that. So it's purely a post only. I've got like a private playlist, which is on YouTube, which only members can see. And so that's how memberships get the benefits from that one. Otherwise, they don't really get that much, which is a shame. I think they would like to get more. But Patreon's a way to go if you're looking at that sort of thing, because that's got a bit more flexibility.
Yeah, I do like Patreon as well, although I only do a few extras for the Patreon patrons. Like, they get a little bit early access to stuff. They usually get a day or two. I was actually in a productivity blitz a couple of weeks ago, so they have a few videos kind of like a few weeks ahead of time. But I do a few behind the scenes stuff, but very few. Like, they pretty much all the content that I have is on YouTube, aside from like three or four videos, something like that. So I feel a little guilty, but hey, my patrons keep telling me that that's not why they're there, so that's always good.
Yeah, I had the same sort of thing when I first started Patreon. Well, fairly early on, I asked my patrons, what did they actually want, and most of them said they were happy just to support me, and they didn't actually want anything. So, which is nice feedback, because it's shows the generosity of the people which are trying to help out.
Yeah, absolutely. Patreon's a great place, and I think the type of people that are drawn to supporting us on Patreon, they're just great kinds of people. I have never had a negative interaction there.
Indeed. It's quite nice to be able to say, like in my main perks, it's basically pre-release videos, and the only thing I can really do is attach the extra documentation which goes with these repairs and stuff I do, or maybe manuals, that kind of thing. I can add those to it. That's basically all the perks I've really got on there. Patreon recently did do a thing though where you could do you can give them like an exclusive sticker or exclusive merchandise or something like that. You can do those kind of thing on their Patreon as well now. So it actually comes out of your Patreon payments. So you lose a bit of money from it, but you're giving back to the patrons a little bit. So when they reach, I think it's after 3 months or something like that, or depending on their levels and stuff there, you got the criteria set up for these particular items, they automatically send them something, which is a nice little perk, I thought.
Yeah, I could ask my patrons if they'd be interested, but it seems like them and my audience are really not interested in physical goods. So I think I'm pretty sure if they received something, they would appreciate it, but they don't seem like that kind of people. Like, I have a Teespring store, and I've sold two items to one person, and that is it. Like, it seems like people are just not into, and I lowered like my profit margin down as low as it could go on their website. So it's not like it's, because I've seen some creators with like $40 t-shirts, and I'm like, what the hell? I just dropped it down. I think I make like a buck off t-shirt or something like that. And still no bites. So
yeah, I'm assigned.
People are just not, at least my viewers are not really into physical goods, it seems.
Yeah, I haven't sold much on Teespring as well. I've sold some items, maybe, I don't know, probably maybe 10 items since I started it a few years ago. So it's not great. And like you, I've only got minimal costs on there. So I think I make about $2 an item or something like that. That's all I've got on it. Can I keep the cost down? But I haven't sold much. And actually, some of those sales were going to someone who's actually a Patreon of mine, a very generous one, actually. And he actually bought them and sent them to me.
That's pretty awesome.
It's funny. So, yeah. So that's actually one of the mugs I've got sitting on my desk, which is a yellow mug with my logo and stuff on it. That's actually one which he purchased and sent to me. That's the one that sits there now.
That's awesome. You also do quite a bit of 3D printing on your channel. What's your favorite kind of stuff to 3D print? Actually, let's start somewhere else. What kind of 3D printer do you have?
I've actually got a few of them. So I started out with the Ender 3, the original one, not long after they first came out. I actually purchased that one myself. And I was using that basically to print 3D print replacement parts of broken test gear. So you get little latches or feet or things like that, which would be missing or broken, and I'd use it to print those. And that's how I basically started out. So a big learning curve, you know, trying to do things like printing ABS is a real challenge. You've got to be really careful about the environment you're in, that sort of stuff, and fumes and what have you. Styrene doesn't smell great when it's burning. And the other printers I've got the Ender 3 V2, which is actually a review item I got from Banggood. So that's the upgraded version, which has got the wider Y-axis on it, which makes it a bit more stable and things like that. So it's a slightly better printer. And it's got just different screen in it. Before, just not a touch screen, which is what I really miss, because the original Ender 3 upgraded that one with some Victory Tech modules and stuff like that. And they had a touch screen on it. It's quite nice. And the Ender 3 V2 doesn't have a touch screen, but it looks like it should have one. I keep going to touch the screen all the time because it's big enough like a touch screen, but and the graphic display is like a touch screen, but it's not a touch screen. It keeps on catching me every single time. And then I've also got a G-Tech. I can't remember the model number now, but it's a dual extruder. So it's actually got two extruders on it. So you can do dual color printing, and you can actually do mixing on it and stuff like that. So I've used that a little bit. And that is really handy to have, because one of the things I've actually done for one project is actually printing a keyboard surround, which has got labeling 3D printed into it. So it's like a flat panel with text on it. And the text is printed in a different color. So what I've done previously is on the original Ender 3, because I've got a 0.2mm nozzle on that, is print in black and then sort the filament out when it gets to the text and print orange over the top of that. And that worked okay. But when I did I thought I was a bit tedious having to do this changeover. And when I sort of G-Tex out, I thought, oh, okay, I'll get one of those to review as well then. And Banggood sent me one of those to review. Again, at no cost to me. And I played with that one a little bit. And I did some 3D printing with that one. And I made some translucent indicator display. So I should start beginning for this one. I've been playing with Datron multimeters as well as repairs. So I had a Datron 1062, which I purchased, which is broken. It arrived, the display was smashed. So it's got a VFD display, so vacuum fluorescent display, and that was broken. So I did a project where I replaced this display, and that includes a bunch of enunciators, stuff like that. So it's got like a 7-digit display sort of thing, 9 of those, and like 8-9 digits or 7 segments. And then it had some enunciators, and this enunciator section was obviously a bit more tricky to deal with. And so I 3D printed on the G-Tech a translucent with a black layer on the top. So the translucent section was the cutouts of the letters, and the black is obviously the front of the lettering, so you wouldn't actually see the LEDs behind it. So I can actually then do an enunciated display with a 3D printed module, basically.
Fancy. Very fancy.
It was interesting.
I can't believe Banggood sent you a 3D printer. They balk at anything over about $100 for me. But I guess you've got bigger audience.
It depends on... it's not that much bigger. Your channel's not much smaller than mine. So you have to sort of build up a long-term relationship with them and they prove that they get results. And as long as they get results, they'll give you more and more and more. That's what I found. I mean, when I first started at Banggood, I was getting $80 items. It'd be like the top limit. So I've gradually built up over time. And because I've done a lot of reviews with them, I've got a bit more trust with them, I think. I think they trust me a bit more to give me the outlay.
Yeah, I guess so. Which is, I mean, that's pretty neat. I mean, I've resorted to building my own 3D printer since they won't send me one, which is fine. So I'm building like a giant one at the moment. I've got the plan is to have a 550 by 250 by 250 build volume. So okay. So far, I mean, I need to update my patrons on this one with pictures, but so far I've got the motor mounts done, the X mounts done, I've got the frame mounts done. I'm all designing all these parts and 3D printing them myself. And yeah, it's chugging along there, but that's the goal. It's going to be some sort of Core XY monster, I think.
Cool, sounds like a nice project. There's a sort of thing with doing those kinds of projects. It's much more satisfying. You know, you get a lot more satisfaction by doing something. You've built it yourself, you designed it yourself, and you put it together, and you get the end result, and you get exactly what you want because that's what you designed it to be, which is brilliant. You know, that sort of thing is really good. That's another reason to be interested in doing these projects and getting into these things yourself, because you can get the result you want yourself in the end instead of putting up with something else that somebody else designed.
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure. It's just, the unfortunate part is that I'm lacking for time. So it takes me about, it takes me about 4 or 5 hours to design each part for this thing. And then it takes, another 4 or 5 hours to print it. So it's a long-term thing. It takes up a lot of space and takes up a lot of mental space as well, which is why I like the product reviews. I know those videos don't have a lot of intellectual potential for my audience, but at the same time, it's so easy for me to knock out a product review. And then, if it's from Banggood, then I get, I have another piece of gear that I can add to my test suite compared to doing something like this. Like, I probably have, I've made a remote control snow speeder, basically a remote control three skied fan, ducted fan type thing, vehicle, like completely designed and 3D printed. It took hundreds of hours and, ended up with 1,100 views and, a 10-minute video. So there's a little bit of, there's a difference in the amount of effort it takes to make those videos. Mind you, I made this thing for fun, but, you can't make those kinds of videos once a week, unfortunately.
No. It's always troubling trying to get a good mix of content as well. Like, I know there are channels out there which focus on one kind of content. I just do one video, the same thing over and over and over again. And in some ways, that's a good thing because YouTube loves that. That loves that repeatability. So people which subscribe to that channel will watch just about every video until they get bored with that format. And then they'll leave, which is the risk you play. But when you've got a mixture of content like we have, then, for example, I'm doing mailbag videos, product reviews, electronic repairs, anything else I might be fixing or whatever, and also live streams and stuff, which could be anything. That mixture can hinder YouTube a little bit as far as promoting, because people don't like every mailbag video you do, or they might not like mailbag at all. They might want only repairs, or some people only, they like both, they'll watch both. But when you get people which don't watch all of the videos, it actually hinders you on YouTube. So having a variety of content on the channel can actually make it harder to grow, in theory at least. So, yeah, I mean, I've seen some channels, there's one which comes to mind, I'm digressing slightly from what you're saying, but the Northridge Fix, he does lots of repairs. He's like a specialist, he does lots of repairs, all sorts of like games consoles and all things like that. Anything he gets given, he fixes it. He does a lot of really good videos. Very concise. He gets quite complex repairs down quite size. He does a good job. But he is doing the same thing over and over again. It's just repair after repair after repair. And he's grown tremendously. Like when he first started out long ago, he was a much smaller channel than mine. He only had a couple of thousand subscribers, for example. And then next time I looked, he had like 5,000 subs. The next time I looked, he had 12,000 subs. And I looked again, he had 30,000 subs. And he's just growing and growing. He's like, it's well over 100,000 now. It's incredible. It's great growth because he's just doing the same thing over and over again. The viewers watch every video. YouTube love it. So, there's a trade-off between making what you want to make versus making stuff that keeps YouTube happy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But, you have a full-time job as well, right?
Yeah.
So what motivates you to, go home after a day of work and make some YouTube videos? What's your motivating factor?
It varies a bit, really. I mean, sometimes when I first started doing YouTube, it was quite exciting. It's like, oh, great, what can I do today? And now I've been doing it for, I think maybe 5 years now, I think I've been doing it. The attitude's changed somewhat. Now it's more of, okay, what do I have to do today rather than what do I want to do today? So it's a case of now more of it's turned to being a bit more of a slog for me. I still enjoy it, but I have to actually try and motivate myself more these days to try and get something done. Maybe it's because it's what I've changed to be doing more. I'm trying to do more involved repairs, stuff like that. So it's a bit more effort involved rather than a quick little thing, which is easy to throw out. So that can be troubling. But yeah, it's motivation's hard. But I suppose I just like to tinker with things. I like to fix things. And that's my passion. I like to fix things. So I just like to share what I'm doing in that way. And maybe it will help somebody else which may have the same issue with their equipment or something very similar to that, or similar piece of equipment which has the same kind of symptoms. What came about from this originally was the many years ago I built a website called Radio Mods, and it's basically CB radio orientated and ham radio mostly, but more CB than anything. And that was about modifications and repair information kind of thing, to a point like circuit diagrams, that kind of thing. And one of the things I'd do is I'd repair CB radios myself as well. That's when I didn't be doing that since I was 13 or so. And I was seeing the same kinds of faults over and over again. Same symptoms, same faults. And I thought, well, if you know how to fix that fault, you can fix, you know, half the radios kind of thing. If you just know that one thing. And that kind of motivated me to do the YouTube channel a little bit. Because I thought, well, if I can show this fault, maybe that'll help a whole bunch of people who are trying to fix their gear. You know, and it just sort of grew from that. And I was just, you know, I was also inspired a lot by Dave Jones from EV Blog, where his eyes have been a big influence on a lot of people because he's achieved so much and he's done a really good job of what he's done. And, you know, when I saw his videos and I first discovered Dave, I was actually stunned about the content he produced and the complexity of what he could do and his knowledge. I was really impressed by the whole lot. And I binge watched hundreds of videos just like for a week. I just did nothing but watch Dave's videos. It's incredible when I first found him. And I was really inspired by that. And actually, and that helped me to decide to basically create a YouTube channel. And I thought, right, I can do something a bit like this, not to the same level as Dave, but I can certainly give it a go.
And a go you have given it. And in fact, if you guys go over to the Def Poms YouTube channel, which you guys should, if you're not subscribed, hit that subscribe button. His banner includes a picture of him standing next to Dave Jones. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah, sure. So what happened is Dave actually did a little break. He went on holiday a few years ago, and he offered up guest spots for guest videos. So I thought, oh, this is a good opportunity to try and get some of my content out there and spread the word about my channel a bit more. So I offered up a guest video, which was actually doing a repair on the Fluke 5200A calibrator, which I mentioned before. So there's quite a complex circuitry in there for an oscillator section, which is used to generate voltages. And I actually demonstrated this oscillator section going through each phase of an oscillator because it's got like a three-phase oscillator on it. And I did that as a guest video on his channel, and he published that for me. And I got a nice boost in subscribers. That was really good. And then a few months later, I'll go into a bit more detail about something else. Actually, I was going to digress slightly here. That was at the very beginning of January. I think it was like the 1st or 2nd of January, something like that. And a few days later, there's a big storm came through here. And massive storm. I'm actually live on the coast. And it blew all the sea in. And my house and my section was completely flooded. So we had seawater ingress everywhere, and it's like a foot deep in parts of the house, that kind of thing. And let's excuse my cat. No. She's lost
this
me.
This is what cats do. they make their presence known.
Yeah. So that happened to me. I was basically living in my garage in my motorhome. Luckily, I had a motorhome, and so I actually had somewhere to sleep. So I lived in that for 6 months during that time. And towards the end of that, when the house was just being fixed, it took like 6 months for them to fix the house. And right at the end of that time, just before the house was ready, we decided we wanted to have a break, you know, because it's not a great life living in a garage and in a motorhome for 6 months. Motorhomes are right, but it's something I built, and it wasn't built for living in, it's built for working from, because it's something I actually did for events we work at. And so it's like good seating, but not much else. As a table for working on, that sort of it. And anyway, so I went to go and see Dave. I've digressed somewhat. So I went to go and see Dave, I think it was in July. That was about three, four years ago. I can't remember which year it was now. But so I actually said to Dave, hey, do you fancy some visitors? You know, and he said, yeah, sure. So that was good. So we went up to Sydney and went up to Gold Coast first. Spent a week at the Gold Coast. Then flew down to Sydney to go and see Dave. That's the reason we went to Sydney, so I could go and see Dave, and my wife can go and see some sites. She wanted to see Sydney, and that was a motivating factor for me, to go and see Dave. So I actually went to Dave's lab and spent the basically half a day there. So we went out there. I think we got there about 9 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And we were there basically the whole day. And we actually went out, and Dave bought me lunch and stuff as well. It was really nice of him. So it was good. So it's really interesting, you know, getting to actually meet Dave and have a good chat with him. And I actually took him a little present, which is something my wife suggested, actually. She did a really good job there. She's got at suggesting things. as a calculator, little calculator, which he actually ended up doing a video on, showing it, you know, and he featured me in it briefly as well in his video. And because I knew he's got a bit of a passion for calculators and collecting those things, so it was a really good gift to give him, and he seemed to like it. I've seen it pop up from time to time in his videos as well. He still shows it occasionally. When he's doing his whiteboard shots, you see it sometimes sitting on the whiteboard. That's pretty cool. And yeah, so that's how I got to basically meet Dave, and I'm sort of friends with him, you know, sort of friends, you know. Well, I suppose you could say acquainted is more so, but I chat to him occasionally, and yeah. So
hey, you're in charge of telling the story. If you want to be called friends, we'll call you friends.
So, I'm not close friends with Dave. I know him all right, but I'm not close friends with Dave.
So what's he like in person? Is he kind of the same as on camera, or is he a little bit more relaxed?
He's very much the same, actually. Is what you see on camera is pretty much that is Dave. You know, he's a really nice guy. We like him a lot. He's a good guy.
Well, you know, since you and Dave are on a first name basis, maybe you can convince him to come onto the podcast one day.
I could suggest it to him. Yeah, I know you already had Clive on.
Yeah, I did. I did have Big Clive on. That was special. I did not think he would be up for it, but he was more than up for it. So there we go.
Cool. Yeah, I'll chat to Clive sometimes too.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what's weird about Big Clive is he's exactly like he is on video, except nicer. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but he's the nicest guy. I talk to him on Patreon from time to time, and he is just such a nice guy.
Yeah, he is.
We are very genuine. Yeah, he is, absolutely. We're in the kind of like the tail end of the podcast, and I always ask my guests one question, and just to see the different answers. Do you mind if I hit you with that question now?
Yeah, sure.
So the question goes, you get some government agency offering you a large government grant to start the business of your dreams. It does not have to be profitable. But it does have to provide a service or a product. What kind of business would you start?
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
Take your time.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky one. I mean, I'm not really a business person. That's the thing. You know, it'd probably be something which would generally benefit a lot of people, so they could get a lot of benefit from it. I don't know. That's kind of what I'm like, is trying to, I don't know.
So just to...
Something which would benefit a lot of people. I don't know. I can't really think of anything.
Yeah. So just to set your mind straight a little bit, because not everyone is a business person, the presumption is that there's a large grant. So you could hire someone to do all the business side, and you could be the people facing side, or you can be management. You could be whatever you want in this business. So I guess it's really open to what your wildest dreams would be.
Yeah, well, I don't really think like that. That's the thing. So, I mean, for me, it'd be probably something involving repair, you know, recycling electronics, which would be reserviceable. And so it could be purchased or obtaining broken things, which is my passion, and then fixing them and then making them available to other people for a cheap price, something like that, you know. That kind of thing would be what I've... would imagine I would do. What I have done in the past, although it's not really a business, it's more of a hobby, is I actually built an auction site, like a classifieds and auction site. So there's a big site here in New Zealand called Trade Me. I also operate in Australia now. And it's a bit like eBay, but smaller. And they actually, I don't know, I had some issues with them. I wasn't doing anything wrong, but they were giving me some trouble. They just being a bit funny with me, but they annoyed me enough to actually build my own auction site. So I built a site, and it's free. So anyone can just go onto my website and just use it and sell stuff and what have you. I did that just because they annoyed me.
Hey, everyone, just a quick interruption. Scott and I were discussing after this episode that there may be some privacy issues with sharing the URL, so I have muted the URL in the podcast. Trust me, it was a cool project. Back to the show. And like, are there active users now still?
Yeah. It's not a very big site though. I mean, it's actually, it grew for a while. And then because I've basically stopped promoting it, stopped doing anything with it, it's just gradually been shrinking again. So it's never a big site. It's just small, you know, very, you know, it's not a great design. I mean, technically the code is okay. Functionally, it works well, but I'm not a good visual designer, so it doesn't look very nice.
So we need some bigwig like eBay to come buy you out for several billions of dollars then.
Yeah, that would be nice. We could buy more stuff to fix.
Well, sorry, TradeMe is a site you had issues with. What's your site called? Okay, so we'll link it in the description and we'll have people go take a tour. Now, Scott did say that the visuals are not going to be great, but I think he...
No, it looks pretty bad. It's pretty dated. I built it 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, the viewers will have will get to see for themselves, basically. All right. Is there anything else you want to touch on, Scott?
Well, that auction site, as I mentioned, the coding on that, at the time when I built that, I knew very little about using PHP and MySQL and that sort of stuff. I have very little experience with that. And that was basically my intro to doing web-based server-side scripting. And so when I built that site, I learned about PHP, I learned about MySQL, CSS, JavaScript, a bit more detail, and that sort of stuff. So that allowed me to progress and do some other projects as well. And that was a really good foundation for me. It was a really good learning experience when I built that site. It took me over a year to build it. And a lot of that time was me trying to figure out how to write this code and make it work and make it reliable and make it robust. And huge learning experience, which is great. And I've gone on to do some other sites, and I've actually built stuff for Dave. I built a little thing for Dave once. He's got his video list page. Can't remember the URL for it now. It might be evbog.org, I think it might be. And it just lists all his videos, and I actually built that page for him. So it just grabs all the videos from a folder and displays them on a page. Little things like that. So it's been a really good experience for that. But if anyone's not into coding yet, I should just say learn it and get into it, because it's extremely helpful.
Yeah, no kidding. It's and especially going forward, some very intelligent people that I know are saying now, if you have children, you must teach your children at least the basics of coding in today's day and age, because going forward, there's going to be nothing else. Like a lot of jobs are going to be sort of made redundant by AI and stuff, but someone's going to have to look at and maintain the code. So everyone, especially the younger generation, they need to learn at least the basics of coding. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You have to look towards the future and what's coming. And, technology is always advancing, and it's always advancing through code. Someone's written some code to do that. And who knows what the next big thing could be.
Exactly. That's entirely true. I am, and I completely understand the people that they're having issues with learning to code. For some reason, coding doesn't work with my brain particularly well. It's very difficult for me to learn to code. Like I'm trying, but it's hard for me. I think the effort is worth it. So start like me, start smashing together examples and libraries, and then eventually start writing your own stuff, I guess.
Well, all I can say is copy and paste is your friend.
It is.
That's a lot of stuff I do is copy and pasting.
Yeah, that's very true.
It's simple as that.
Just
find an example, copy it, paste it in, maybe modify it slightly to see what you want, maybe merge in some other examples, and just piece it together.
If just someone could write code to do that for you, though, now that would be great. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to come chat with me today. And I apologize, I had to cancel on our last session last Friday. That was due to my vaccination kicking in hard.
At least you've got a vaccination. That's good.
Yeah, that's number two. So I'm done up until the Americans force us to get a booster by them, incubating the variants for us.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'm sorry, my American viewers. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. It's not all your fault. Wink, wink. So, yeah, thank you so much. And for the listeners, I need you guys to go over to Scott's channel linked in the description below or on your screen if you're on YouTube. I need you to go over, hit that subscribe button, and I need you to go to one of his videos any one of them, let's say the latest one, watch the video through and add a comment saying that you came from the podcast. I know that YouTubers really like seeing positive comments, so go ahead and do that. I'm sure Scott would be thrilled. Right, Scott?
Certainly would be, Dan. Certainly would be.
All right. And I want to thank you guys all for listening. We'll catch you in the next one. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot, Dan. Bye.